Gordy, thank you. That was appropriate for Halloween, the Erie. And I often get questions, where does Erie Family Health Center get its name? Was it Erie, Pennsylvania, or was it Erie, like Halloween? And since it was just Halloween.
Like the fantasy clinic, right?
Right. But it is true about the difference between the word, the nomenclature of clinic, which is sort of a rusty chair in the waiting room, take a number, you may or may not be seen that day, and you may or may not get the comprehensive services that you need, versus the nomenclature health center, where you can just conjure up a more comprehensive approach. And just by me, what I hope to do today is to just a little bit about our health center, but to put it in the broader context of some of the things that Rebecca was talking about, very hard act to follow, and the passion that I've learned this morning is something that I've just taken away a lot just from your presentation. I hope to be able to combine what you said. Erie Family Health Center did start on Erie Street in 1957, right over here. But over the last few years, we've really grown tremendously. I'm proud to say we're even almost to Wisconsin now, in Waukegan, Illinois, and in Evanston. And some people who are from the Chicago area have said, Evanston? Really? It's one of the more well-to-do suburbs of Chicago. But come to find out that, as Rebecca has pointed out, these pockets of poverty that exist in the communities that are no longer inner city urban. They are now inner city suburban, to coin a new phrase. So we now have 13 health centers throughout the greater Chicago area, and they are health centers, and we want them to look and feel beautiful, like Nordstrom. Where my mom used to take me shopping, Mom. I haven't been there for a couple of years now. But Mom's no longer here, so I have to like keep up the mom thing. But we want them to be beautiful because we feel that patients should be respected when they come to a place of where they receive direct health care. We know that we cannot always make their homes beautiful as our health centers, but we want them to feel that they've been relieved when they've come to one of our health centers. This one on the bottom right is our first health center on the campus of a hospital, Swedish Covenant Hospital. This one over here is the former City of Chicago Department of Public Health, Westtown Clinic, which was Gordy, Marge, others, 1972 inside. And we converted it into a beautiful health center. This health center is a former factory building, which was an urban renewal project. And this one is our health center in Evanston, Illinois, just to show you a few of the facilities. Now, one of the things I think about as patients come to health centers is also the employees that work there, and how if you have a satisfied employee staff, we have over 500 employees, most of them are from the communities that we serve. If the employees are satisfied, and if you can create a quality environment, I know Lon Berkeley's here from Joint Commission. If you can create a quality environment and you can create a satisfied workforce, how far that goes into be able to provide services to patients, not only the direct medical care, but the social aspects of their care as well. And so it wouldn't be APHA if I didn't put on the screen, for all you public health people, a 4x4 box. Ha ha ha, when was the last time you saw that? And so I wanted to get a little bit into access to care and how on a community level we've responded to access to care, and then a little bit more about some of the other things that Rebecca brought up that are considered access to care now, which maybe previously weren't so much thought about. So, after a few years of Obamacare, my feeling is that we're over here in this box, the best, hopefully one of the best case scenarios, which was to expand the insured and expand community capacity. But we could have gone, and we could be going back down to, depending on what happens in Washington, D.C. over the next couple of years, to some of these other boxes, which would be more a regression. So for example, less expansion of the insured and less access to care, expanding community capacity, that would be unsustainable. Expanding the insured but not continuing to expand capacity, that might mean long lines, or we could have the status quo, which it seems like we don't have. But just as long as we were at APHA, I thought I'd make up a four by four box. And also to say that, and this is something Rebecca brought up too, is that even with expansion of insurance, even if you took a Blue Cross card out of your pocket or a Land of Lincoln, LOL, Land of Lincoln card, or if you took a Family Health Network or one of the plans that are Medicaid, MCO, Managed Care Organizations, the insurance card is really just a piece of freaking plastic. It really is. It does not really provide anything. It doesn't provide access to care. It doesn't provide quality of care. It doesn't even provide knowledge about access to some of the supportive and wraparound very important services, whether it's legal, whether it's social, or whether it's direct medical care. But it will pay for some stuff, which is actually not too bad. And health centers across the country, community health centers like Erie Family Health, which is a federally qualified health center, are an important part of the answer to that question. A network, a national network, a very large national network. Isn't it ironic that H. Jack Geiger is one of the authors of this paper that Rebecca mentioned, Dr. Geiger? This paper of the New England Journal in 2010 at the launch of Obamacare, which said, hey, wait a minute. They were writing, hey, wait a minute. Where are all these people gonna go with their insurance cards? There's a capacity problem, and community health centers are an important part of that. And so as of last year, here is the network of community health centers across the United States. Anybody, I would encourage you to squint your eyes and look at this map of the United States. And to just imagine the social history of some of these regions of the country. Rebecca already mentioned Mound Bayou, Mississippi, or maybe it was the other first community health center in Boston with Count Gibson, or maybe it's the Central Valley of California where our lettuce and tomatoes, pistachios, and grapes come from, or maybe it's the Rio Grande Frontera in Texas. Or maybe it's other ports of entry around the country where patients and people and families come to us. This network of 22 million patients prior to maybe 10 years ago really wasn't thought of as a system of care, but now it really is. And even in certain states, up to 1 in 5 people, residents of the state, attend community health centers for the regular source of care. In Illinois, almost 8%. In California, almost 7%. In Washington, a high percentage. West Virginia, 20%. Maine, 13%. This is part of a system now. And so we have great influence as community health centers to be able to impact the care of millions of people. We're up against the United Healthcares and the Aetnas in our ability to influence patients. Well, this is what it looks like in Chicago, in the Chicago area, and I know there's a lot of, how many are local folks here, or have been local folks, or have even been to Chicago before? You may know some of the geography of Chicago. This is now a GIS plot of all the different community health center delivery sites. Now, some of the yellow ones are homeless shelters that maybe are open maybe once a week or something like that. But you see a system of care, not only in the urban Chicago, but now Elgin, Aurora, and if this went all the way to Lake County, you would see some of those. And the darker the green shade is the percentage of the population in poverty. The way I set this up is the percentage of patients in people in poverty, of the population in poverty, who attends a community health center for their care. And in some of these neighborhoods, it's greater than 60 to 80%, some 20, 40 to 60%, and some 20%. So this is a great system of care that we have a real potential to influence not only the care that's given at a visit, but the care that's delivered in between patient visits. Now, during my time at Erie Family Health Center, which dates back to 1991, but starting in 2001, when I started to get involved in administration, I want to talk about that a little bit. We had about 17,000 patients in calendar year 01 in our practice, and it's greatly expanded over the year. But here was when we decided strategically that we wanted to be out ahead of the curve in terms of the Affordable Care Act and getting ready for that and sort of building on the opportunity for that. So just looked at the numbers last night, and for calendar year 15, we're going to report 67,000 when we get to the end of the year. So we've been on sort of this exponential growth, and I want to just talk about that a little bit in terms of what that means even financially. This is our annual expenditures, income and expenditures. Blue is income, revenue, and red is expenditure. Since I'm a muckety-muck now, Gordy, I have to talk about the money. And every year, as a nonprofit, we've made a little bit of money. Then we started to grow really fast, and whoops, in 2014, we lost a lot of money. And now we're hopefully going to be back on track. But to me, this delta here is what we use to invest in what Rebecca said is the stuff that doesn't get paid for now. If we have a dollar at the end of the day, we'll be able to invest and provide services, not only bricks and mortars, but the wraparound services that we need for our patients. So it's a growth to meet need. It's not only in patients and numbers, but it's also in our ability to finance and be financially stable. It's an incredible important part of public health that I wasn't fully aware of as a resident, as a student, but I did learn that in public health school and tried to apply that at a community health center. Now, everyone asks me, well, do you still have uninsured patients at community health center? Are you still a safety net provider? Are you still there for people who really need you? Well, the blue is Medicaid, and in Illinois, those are folks that are at 138% of the federal poverty level or below. Illinois is in a Medicaid expansion state. The green is self-pay, uninsured. And you can see over the course of a year, self-pay has reduced a little bit. It's now about 30%. But in a state where we have less than 10% uninsured, having 30% uninsured in your healthcare practice is carrying a huge shoulder of the load. 98% of our patients live at the federal poverty level. So this is a very highly challenged patient population. And you might say, well, why still so uninsured? And well, that's because we still have a highly immigrant population in Chicago in our neighborhoods. And unbeknownst to many people in Washington, D.C., or perhaps overly benounced, a lot of people don't qualify for publicly funded health insurance. So these folks pay on a sliding fee scale, and of course we would never refuse services based on the ability to pay. Now this is the same thing for new patients. We're entering about 1,000 new patients a month into our health center, and you can see even the new patients, we're still seeing a large percentage of uninsured. It's very matched, and we control this. We control it. We want to make sure that we're still able to welcome patients who have no health coverage into our patients, just as we welcome patients, our rich payers, our Medicaid patients, our Medicare payers, and now we're seeing a little bit more third-party insurance, maybe some of the exchange plans here in purple. So it's an interesting demographic. Now, just a little bit about what's going on in a Medicaid expansion state. Prior to Medicaid expansion in Obamacare in Illinois, we had a single-payer system. For the PNHP folks in the audience, we had a one Medicaid payer, and that was the state. And they did pay, and it was a little inefficient, but it was one plan, one payer. And it was pretty simple. See a patient, get billed. Get bill, see a patient, bill, see a patient, bill, get paid. And that's sort of the old-fashioned way. And this was the Department of Health Care and Family Services. And there was no pre-authorizations, it was standard, everything was standard, and patients could basically show up in any hospital emergency room that they chose, and there was really no, very few controls. There was very little management of what goes on between the clinic visits or the health center visits and what goes on at the health center visit or in the ER. And so over the period of the last few years, there's been a transformation in our state. There are these new managed care organizations that were formed at the community level, ACEs, accountable care entities, coordinated care entities that were piloted under the previous administration in Illinois. These allowed grassroots formation of health insurance companies. Unfortunately, with the new administration in Illinois, they're being asked to move over to existing Medicaid managed care companies because there's just not the stomach to move forward with something so innovative. And there was a little bit of an effort in the olden days under straight Medicaid in Illinois to assign patients primary care doctors. That was called primary care case management. So we went from the single sort of simple system, and now we have this. This is just in Cook County. This is a cacophony of insurance plans that all provide Medicaid services. Now, this is bewildering to someone like me who has, you know, a medical degree, a public health degree, a college education. I talk to people about this, but can you imagine if you're a patient and you get in the mail a letter, choose one of these plans, and now we're going to manage your care. Your care will be managed by one of these companies. And so maybe you've heard of some of these on the list here. I'm not particularly endorsing any of them, but I have to say that in Cook County alone, which is the county we're in right now, there are 17 plans all competing with each other, and there are more that want in. What we decided to do is to choose a few of them and to work with a few of them and to leverage our data to be able to work with just a few of them and to pick a few and to try and maximize that so that we can begin to coordinate care and work on managing the patients in between their visits, not just as much as at their visits. So we picked just a few of them, some of them for different age groups. Here are the ones that we own, partial owner of this one and this one. This one failed. This one's still going. County Care is going strong. But some of these on this side are the homegrown ones, and some of these are the pre-existing ones on this side. So in order to do this, we need data, and we are an owner of a health center-controlled network in Chicago called the Alliance. Four health centers banded together about 15 years ago. We created a company, a limited liability corporation, and we deliver a service called health center network-controlled electronic health records out to 32 health centers from Hawaii to upstate New York, and including 18 health centers in the Chicago area and also into Iowa. And this allows us to track on a real-time basis certain measures. Now, these are the standard ones Rebecca was talking about, but diabetes control, but we also are developing the capacity now to track some of these other socially driven measures. Some of them are in between, like body mass index. Some of them are in between, like smoking status or whether smoking cessation was delivered to the patient. But there's because we have a network, the Alliance, we can modify the electronic health record content that clinicians see on their screen and that our care coordinators see on their screen so that we can collect this data on a better basis. So just as a reminder, none of this comes just because a patient has an insurance card. We're trying to build the right side of this equation. and we're trying to build it robustly. So Gordy asked me to close by talking about some of my lessons learned. And so Gordy, I found this picture from County Hospital days, and this is actually me. And this is actually here. This part right here is actually hair. This is SEIU signs, which now I'm management, so I have to be very careful what I say. So I wanted to just talk about just a couple of lessons learned from being a resident in Cook County, where they shipped me out to Erie Family Health Center as a resident every Thursday night, and that's how I found out about my job, what I would be for the rest of my life. So thank you for that. Well, one thing is the 2000 rule. The 2000 rule is my own rule. As an individual clinician, I could have 2000 patients, maybe 1500 in my individual clinical practice. But now I feel like I'm personally responsible for 67,000. So what can I do to influence those 67,000? So the 2000 rule is something I think about every day. I still see patients and I'm aware of what goes on in the trenches. But what about that inherent public health approach, that direct philosophical transfer of this approach to the community center, the talking, listening, and examining and touching? Also has a way that we touch patients in between their visits. My dad is 87 years old. He was in the hospital last week at one of our partner hospitals. It wasn't Stroger and it wasn't Northwestern, in case you were wondering. And during his 3 days in the hospital, he received from his doctors, his hospitalist and his resident and his student, a total accumulated time of 5 minutes of touch time. 5 minutes. I was there the entire time. I defended him from death. I literally defended him from death. And I feel that community health centers and this touch in between the visits are the answer to what we're missing now in the healthcare environment. The other lesson I learned, yes, the access to listen to the highest standard, to coordinate and manage care. But I also think about our staff. I think that they're from the communities that we serve to the large part. They deserve fair compensation and benefits. They have the opportunity to work at the top of their license, whether they are a call center operator or a medical assistant or a physician, a nurse practitioner, a midwife. These are the lessons that I've learned. I'm gonna turn it back over to Gordy. And I want to thank you for your attention. I really appreciate the opportunity to piggyback onto Rebecca and her comments. And I'm going to turn it back to one of my mentors. I failed to mention, Gordy, that, of course, Marge Cohn is here. And when I put up the slide of the long hair, I know, Marge, you had to endure that because you were my first teaching attending on July 1st of 1988 when it was 105 degrees in Chicago. And I'll never forget that. So thank you.
Those were the days when, the first treatment for congestive heart failure is to put someone in a cooler environment to tone down their metabolism. And so we would have to send patients home. They were too sick to stay in the hospital. So how about a few questions for Lee, and then we can open it up. I know we're just a few minutes later than I thought, but go ahead, Julie.
Well, thanks for a great presentation. I do pharmacoepidemiology. My question is directed to how well you know that the medication management of your patient is followed.
It's, first of all, we don't know enough. We know that it's a surface that we're scratching, and we now are going towards things like fill histories, bringing pill counting. Some more high-tech ways of perhaps monitoring patients, but we're just at the very beginning of that. And this is something that, the other day I get a letter in the mail from a managed care company. And it said, we have an indication that your patient is not taking their medication. We have an indication. And here's our data, and it was from 6 months ago. But pharmacoepidemiologic-wise, I can now go into my electronic health record system and click on a button and get the immediate fill history live time. So we don't have to wait for the insurance companies. But what we want to do is to be able to engage our staff so that we can proactively push that back out to patients rather than for waiting until it's 6 months later.
It's like Ida, then Ali.
Ida Bollinger. Thank you very much.
Stand up, Ida, just for the room noise level.
Ida Bollinger. I work in the Division for National Health Program. We've been a lot of time member support for the cost. I was wondering what's happening to your administrative costs with all these new Medicaid managed care insurers that you have to interact with for your funding. Yeah. If you know from your end,
I have to say that the question was, what about administrative costs? So you might think if you're going to focus on managing patients in between their visits.
No, actually, with all the multiple payers versus a single payer.
Well, I see. So you're asking how are we managing billing and all of that kind of thing?
Is it making it more complicated? Yeah.
Medicaid managed care mandated in
yes.
Illinois. They want to cut their payments to you. How do you react to collect what you need to, and doesn't that raise your administrative costs?
Three answers. First of all, we're still, as Rebecca pointed out, we're still in a fee-for-service environment. So no matter how hard we try to do the right thing, we still get paid for the visit, which is not good.
Unless they don't pay you.
Unless they don't pay us. There's a court decree where they're supposed to pay us right now, even though we don't have a budget. Second thing is, we are trying to invest by bringing on staff that will in the future reduce costs so that perhaps we can share in some of the riches that are out there, number two. And number three, it's going to take a few years for this to happen, and everyone's very impatient. So there's a lot of movement afoot, and there's some really great projects in Chicago, some of which are highly succeeding. Medical Home Networks, ACO with County Care, and reducing costs by taking the care coordination and overhead, take it away from the insurance company, let us do it because we can do it better for a lower cost.
Ali?
Thank you, Dr. Fine. Luckily, I have a really good answer for this.
Shoot, I just can't remember it.
Yeah. Just as we can, one of our clinicians can order a cardiology consultation, they can order a medical legal consultation. And although it's very refined and it's very good, and it goes along the same lines of what's accomplished in health leads without as many of the frontline staff. But we have a very well nationally awarded medical legal partnership with Loyola Health Law Program, and we deploy that out to all of our sites. And that they've actually changed the law in Chicago on several occasions based on some of the interactions that we've had. It uses law students and then a mentor professor, and they bring in slews of law students, and it really makes a difference.
I don't know if people realize, and I hope I'm speaking accurately, but that graphic of that prescription pad where you check off, you know, electricity needs and food insecurity is not just a graphic to illustrate a slide. That's an actual representation of a prescription pad, right? It's electronic or paper that you guys use, right? So that's literally what happens in these clinics that Rebecca described. Another hand. Yeah, Rebecca should come up too. And Lon, go ahead for a question. Yeah. Will you still accredit this clinic? That's the question she would get.
Long-term supporter of the community health center movement, and As you described, both great presentations, what I felt was missing, even Lee and yours, was talking about the unique aspect of the health and being community, patient forward and operating. Also, where Rebecca in a paradigm shift. To me, if we leave out the role of patients, consumers, and their families, of course, we're going to miss the opportunity, because that's part of the highlight of where we're moving in the future. I just want to elaborate on why you left it out, and that's sort of what Erie is doing in the area of consumer patient oriented family care.
By federal guidance, health centers, they're nonprofits, so they're not owned actually, but they are governed by governing boards. 51% or more should be users of health center services. So my bosses are patients of the health center, and there is nothing like sitting in a board meeting when your patients are going at you with what they need. And so that's something that we constantly have to respond to, and we take it very, 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 very seriously. And, you know, it's almost like you have the white shirts on one side of the room and the patients on the other side of the room. But at our health center, they go to dinner together. They are very well integrated. They respect each other for their talents. And it's a really great model. And it's really part of what makes community health centers truly community-based.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say that, well, obviously many healthcare institutions are not community health centers. And so the question is kind of, how do you even begin that journey in some ways? You know, I think part of what we get really excited about is changing patients' expectations of what they can ask of the healthcare system. And so, you know, what does it mean when a patient actually can go into the clinic and expect to be able to talk to her physician around the full set of things that she needs to be healthy? Because that's an explicit part of the visit, as opposed to something that comes up in crisis, or because you have, you know, a heroic physician who's taking all this extra time outside the allotted time, or a patient who, you know, has the wherewithal in the context of the complexities of healthcare to be able to articulate what she knows she needs and what her family needs to be healthy. So part of what we really love is patients coming to expect this of care delivery, and you know, that's part of what we're working towards. We believe that's kind of a critical lever as you think about driving provider behavior over time, particularly when you think about, you know, these patient populations being patient populations that increasingly are, for lack of a better word, kind of valued by non-FQHC traditional healthcare institutions.
So I think one more question or two more questions. Yeah, March. Stand up, March.
On the last statement, I think, like, what I sort of was missing from some of what you said was, you need this whole other group of people to help deal with the electricity and housing, let alone we don't have the houses and things like that. But shouldn't we have these people? I mean, I come out of the HIV movement where people demanded,
right. Mm-hmm.
Well, what we didn't sort of, they pulled us, you know? And I sort of think that, now that you guys are in those kind of positions, maybe people shouldn't be volunteering to do this. Maybe they should be. This is terrible unemployment, young people need jobs. Aren't there ways we could sort
Absolutely.
Of have those people, both at the community center level as well as wherever you're doing all that other work, have people be paid to do that and then make a difference, because they'll be quite much more empowered, because they'll have money to actually do something and join together in unions of people working on this in health centers all over the country, demanding like a single payer, high quality healthcare system.
So I'll say two things on this. So first, you know, Health Leads sort of made the choice back in the day to work with these college student advocates in the belief that the most efficient way to change the healthcare system was to change the leadership of the healthcare system. And, you know, how do we inculcate in this cohort of college students this fundamental understanding of the relationship between health and poverty and patients' basic resource needs? And one of the things that's been actually really powerful is we now have about 75% of our alums, and we have thousands and thousands of alums, are in healthcare. Most of those are working with underserved patient populations. They're increasingly in positions of power, like being the right hand to the head of Medi-Cal in California and being able to influence some of that. And what I will say is that, you know, part of what's been, I think, most exciting for Healthly is watching healthcare institutions increasingly start to invest in community health workers and promotoras. And part of our kind of current work is, so actually, at, for example, the Dimmick Center, which is an FQHD in Boston, having developed these tools like the technology platform and the workflows, actually handing those over to the community health workers in that health center and allowing them to have access to these tools. And part of why Dimmick wants these tools is they want to be able to actually, as you say, make the case for the value of these workforces and be able to actually begin to negotiate for payment for the services they're providing. One of the huge challenges right now is that a lot of these non-clinical workforces are not paid for within the current structure. And so it's a bit of a chicken and egg of how do you then collect data demonstrating the impact that they're having so that they can then get paid for. So that's, I feel like, the front edge of what the opportunity is now, and that's really the sort of focus of Healthly's work at this point, is how do we take those tools and turn them over to these other workforces and other settings.
You want to comment on what are you doing in terms of community health workers and
We've employed health promoters and community lay health promoters and community health workers for many years at Erie, and at Erie Family Health is expanding. But the responsibility that they are getting now is vastly, vastly more complicated and top of the license. I mean, community health workers have really, really expanded their scope. One interesting way that's most coming to light now, Marge, is that we're starting to use some technology that allows us to know, that pings us when our patient hits the emergency department at a certain number of our hospitals. And so we know, while they may have even just registered, and sometimes we can call them on their cell phone using community health worker and say, hi, we just, they're shocked, we called them. You're sitting in the waiting room waiting for what are you there for? A sore throat. Come on over, or we're there because of some crisis that they're having, and so we can intervene even before they're seen. And or they're lying on the stretcher and, what are you doing there? How did you know that I was there? So it allows us to intervene in ways, and with a community health worker. Yes, of course.
All right, one last question. Bruce?
Hi, Bruce Drake from New Mexico. The expansion of Medicaid in the states that did it through HCA is one of the most amazing things I've seen in my career, because I work with people with heroin addiction, opiate addiction, and I have not seen great models for their being integrated now that they have insurance into the primary care healthcare system. Buprenorphine, we've trained hundreds of doctors in New Mexico, and a relative handful are prescribing buprenorphine. And come on, this is a huge problem for the communities, families. And somehow addiction treatment, syringe exchange, you have to go off to some corner of the city. There's no reason that can't be part of primary care. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think there are a few things in my mind that are the final frontier of primary care, like Star Trek, to boldly go where no few people have gone before. One is oral health. I spent all day Saturday here with the oral health group. There's so much more, mental health. And then there's the whole addiction. Maybe you include it in mental health, probably you don't. At our health center, we do have certified providers that do, buprenorphine programs. What happens if they leave and you have to get another one? And now the feds have told us you have to apply specifically for that privilege from the feds in order to include that service in your scope, your federal scope of project. So to me, it was like, well, we write for Tylenol 3 and we write for, a blood pressure medication and hepatitis C treatment, and now we write for buprenorphine. Well, isn't that a treatment for a condition? No, it requires a special application to the feds to be approved to do that. So there's a lot of hoops that we have to jump through in our way.
What is
the funding agency for health centers, which is the Health Services Resources Administration, HRSA. So if you want to provide cardiology services, you have to apply to provide cardiology services. So they're considering buprenorphine as part of that. So.
All right, well, thank you very much. We'll look forward to seeing you next year. Nominations are certainly welcome, and thanks for coming.